well, I don't know whether to congratulate you or give you my sympathy. Welcome to physics again today. Sorry I'm stuck without the big board again today. Every now and then there's some strangeness in the communication of the laptop to the dark projector up there. So we're sort of stuck without it today. Anyway, so we've been talking about rotational motion, and we're going to see some pretty interesting stuff today, actually. Just to remind you, a lot of the way that we're trying to think about this is to look at the rotational analogs of what we already know about in the linear world. So in the linear world, we have sort of a linear distance, a velocity, and acceleration, a mass, a force, kinetic energy, and linear momentum. And in the rotational world, we have the rotational analogs where we use this relationship, S equals R theta, which is good for when theta is a radian measure, so that we get the angle, the angular velocity, the angular acceleration, and then we've discussed this sort of complicated mass, right? You still have to have this concept that if I have some sort of force that causes a rotation, that force is going to be inversely proportional to how heavy the thing is that you want to rotate and where the force is located and how the mass is distributed. So that's what this moment of inertia is about. I forgot to draw an arrow here. And then we have to have an idea of what the angular force is, and that we call torque. So these are the things we've been talking about. And last time we started looking at the angular aspects of these, and just to remind you a little bit about that, up until we started talking about the vectors, we really worried about omega, where omega was just within a given problem. We had something rotating with a fixed orientation, and omega more or less was just how fast it was spinning. But now to do this in a vector way, we have to have a vector that really defines all different types of rotation. So we define the vector omega to be the vector that you would get if something were rotating, if you grasped the axis of rotation with your right hand, such that your fingers curled around in the direction of the rotation, your thumb goes in the direction of omega. Okay, so we define that as the vector omega. And now, the direction of omega determines the plane of orientation for the wheel. The magnitude of omega tells you whether it's going fast or slow. And whether omega is this way or that way determines whether you're spinning like this or spinning like that. Okay, so it really defines this rotation very well. If omega is spinning up, then you have an angular acceleration that is in the same direction as omega, causing it to grow. If you have this thing is slowing down, then the angular acceleration is going to be in the opposite direction of omega, causing a change with unit time that goes from large to something smaller. Okay? So those are sort of the vectors of the kinematic pieces. And then things get a little more complicated with the force, because we have this weird thing. If I take a force and I apply it at the edge of this wheel to make it rotate like this, okay, I'm taking a force, I apply it at this point at a position that is determined from a vector that goes from here to there, and I get a torque which causes an omega off at right angles to all this thing. Right? So it's absurdly complicated, really. It's three dimensions. So all of a sudden, we have to be in sort of three dimensions. So we define the torque. The torque is this angular force, and clearly it depends on the magnitude of a force. So if I push here on the wheel a little bit, I get a little bit of angular acceleration. If I push a lot, I get a lot. So clearly the magnitude of the force is important. If I push with the force out here or I push with it here, I'll get a different rotation. The closer you are to the axis, the harder it is to rotate. So I clearly have to have a distance piece and I have to have a force piece. The other thing is if I push this way out radially, I get nothing. If I take the same force and I push tangentially, I get rotation. So the orientation of the force is very important. So it turns out that the way we can pull all this together is to define the torque using a strange sort of vector multiplication, which we call the cross product. The torque is equal to the cross product, R cross F, where R is the vector that goes from the axis of rotation in the plane of the force, from the axis of rotation to the point where the force is applied. Okay? And then you have the force vector, and you take the cross product between those, and you get something else, which is what we call the torque. And the torque, by definition of cross product, it will be at right angles to both of those two vectors. So we talked a bit last time about the cross product, and I'll just remind you a little bit of those. So the cross product is a general vector multiplication thing. We've already seen one type, which is the dot product. This is a different type. And the dot product, if you recall, is one where you have two vectors and A dot B multiplies the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the cosine of the angle between them if you put the tails together. And what it does is it projects out that piece of one of the vectors that is parallel to the other vector, and it multiplies those pieces. Okay, so really, there's only non-zero if there is a component of the two vectors that is along each other. If they're perfectly perpendicular, you'll have a zero dot product. So the cross product is a different type of multiplication. In this case, the way to think about it is if I have two vectors, and they can have any orientation you want, and I say that I want to look at the cross product, say, of A cross B, a way to think about it is to take these two vectors, and remember I can move them wherever I want so long as they maintain the same orientation and length. So I take B and I put it here, and I take A and I put it here, and I put them in such a way that they're in the plane here, and there's an angle between them that is the... There's also an angle that goes around this way, but when I talk about the angle between them, I'm really meaning the angle that's within the smallest angle between them instead of the larger one. And A cross B, then, is the vector whose magnitude has the magnitude of A times magnitude of B times the sine of the angle. The sine of the angle here would be basically taking the component of A that is perpendicular to B and multiplying it by the magnitude of B. So whereas the dot product takes the component of one of the vectors parallel to the other vector and multiplies it, this one takes the component that's perpendicular and multiplies it. In addition, this is very different from the dot product in that instead of having a scalar or just a number when you get finished, this actually is a vector. It has to have a direction. And you have to know how to compute what that direction is. And last time we learned a bit about what we call the right-hand rule. So to remind you how to do the right-hand rule, is you sort of imagine the plane that contains the two vectors in this plane of the screen here. You take the fingers of your right hand, you put them in the direction of the first vector in the cross product. Okay, so in this case, I put my fingers in the direction of A, and that now my hand can go any way I want at this point. I just have my fingers in the direction of A. So now I orient my hand by making sure that when I curl my fingers, they curl in the direction such that they go from A toward B in the direction of the smallest angle. So in this case, by saying that, instead of having full freedom, I have to orient my hand like that, because that way, when I curl them, they curl from A toward B. Okay? And when I do that, my thumb points in the direction of how we define the cross product. So if I now say that I have a situation where I have this object that can rotate about this axis, and I have a force that is applied at some point on this object, I'll put it here, then I have the force vector, it is what it is. We define the R vector to go from the axis to the point of application of the force. We define the torque that happens on this object that gives it rotation to be R cross F. In this case, I would take F and I would picture in my mind moving it over here, so it's like that. And then I put my fingers along R and I curl them into F. My finger goes out in the direction of the torque. How do you know you're right with that direction? Torque is defined as R cross F, so that's what gives you out of the board. Remember that torque is also equal to I alpha. That's the same thing as F equals ma in rotational form. This is a vector equation, so what it tells you is that the torque goes in the direction of alpha. If I have the torque coming out of the board, I know that it will produce an omega, or give me increasing omega, going out of the board. Because the torque is in the same direction as alpha, and alpha this way, if it starts at zero, it's going to create an omega that is also this way. If the omega is this way, I know that I grab this axis with my thumb along the direction of omega, and my fingers curl in the direction of the rotation. So that means this thing has to rotate this way, which intuitively, you look at it and say, sure, if I push it like that, it's going to rotate that way. Okay? So that's how it hangs together. Any questions on that? Best lecture of the term when you're brain dead is to do this one, I'm sure. But, okay. Let us practice this just a little. So we have two vectors, A and B. The direction of B cross A is in what direction? Bad luck with my... Okay, take your right hand and decide what direction you think it's going to go. And what I'd like you to do in a moment when I ask you to is to just take your finger and point in the direction that you think the cross product would go. So up is like that, down like that, boom, boom, or that way or this way. Okay? Everybody put your hand up. Point in the direction that you think the cross product's going. I see some people doing this. There's no time dependence in this problem. Okay? Fingers along B. Curl it into A. This is going to be bigger than 90 degrees, but I move A over here. It'd be like this. Fingers along D, curl into A. It's going to be that way. Okay? I think I saw most people do that. What does this mean? At the tip of the arrow of the vector A coming out at you. If I were going into the board, it would be a cross. That would be the feathers of the vector going into the board. Okay? So, the direction of B cross A is what direction? Fingers along B. A is coming out at you, like that. Goes that way. Okay? A cross B is what direction here? Fingers along A. B is going into the board in this case. Did you see the feathers of B? Fingers along A. Curl it into the direction of B. That way. Okay? direction of the torque here is what direction? I have the axis of rotation here. I have some weird object. There's where my F is. I don't even show you R this time. R is a vector that goes from here out to there. Fingers along R. Curl it into F. Your thumb points into the board. Okay? And does it make any sense? If you have a torque going into the board, you have an alpha going into the board, you have an alpha going into the board that's currently not moving, you will get an omega that goes into the board. Grasp the axis with your thumb going in the direction of omega, and your fingers will curl like so, which is exactly the direction you might think that torque would take a spin. Okay? Any questions? You may have a TA or a friend who can give you a different way of doing the right-hand rule. Sometimes people do it with three fingers. And you have to have then have some rule such that I put my thumb along the first one, my index finger goes along the second one, and then this finger goes along the third. Because basically I can take my right hand and, you know, get it. So you can do that, but you better remember which fingers you're using. Okay. There is another way to remember this. And I think I will do you a great favor and tell you a story which will probably always keep you from forgetting this. You can imagine, if you remember, imagine that there is a screw that is going into the board here, okay? And you have a screwdriver coming from here and you put it on the head of the screw, okay? And you want to now make this screw go into, you want to screw it into the wood. If I do it the old way, fingers along A, curl it into B, it goes into the wood. If you can picture something like this screw, and you take the screwdriver and you put it up, you twist the screwdriver in such a way that it goes from A to B, and it's screwing the thing into the wood. Okay? So that's another way to remember it. I will never forget that one, because when I was sitting where you're sitting, there was a delightful young woman, whose name is Patty Eller, who sat up in the front row. And I sat back with the senior soccer players, mostly. And we didn't pay much attention to the professor. We mostly watched Patty Eller, because she was really quite voluptuous and beautiful. She's very smart. She had a PhD in organic chemistry, so I wasn't objectifying her, seriously. You know? Maybe just a little, I'm sorry. So, Patty is actually a very brilliant woman. But she tended to be a little spacey, a little flighty. And so she was looking very confused at this. And I had a real goofball for a professor. And he's explaining this. And he turns to her and she looks confused. And he explains it. And he looks at her and says, "Pen, you know how to screw, right?" Oh, my God. The whole back row fell onto the floor. And I have never forgotten this since. So I'm sharing this story with you so that you will never forget it. That professor had no idea what he said. Patty did, though. She turned bright red and goes, "Dr. Stevenson!" It was terrible. I'm still laughing about it. Okay, so we have a wheel. It is rotating. I show you the direction of rotation by this arrow. Never, ever, 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 ever write something like this on a diagram and call it omega. Right? Because this really has no direction. It's a visual aid to give you a sense of the rotation, but it is not omega. Right? That is not defined as a vector. It's not well defined in any way, shape, or form. However, you will often see it give you a sense of the rotation because we sort of have to do that. So here we have a wheel that's rotating like that. It's rotating counterclockwise. What is the direction of omega? Remember to get omega, you grab the axis with your right hand. Your fingers curl in the sense of the rotation of the thing. So in this case, they curl like that. Your thumb comes in the direction of omega. Okay? It's slowing down. What is the direction of alpha? Omega is that way. It is getting smaller. Therefore, alpha has to be in the opposite direction. Okay? This stuff will not go away. You need to make sure that you're totally 100% cool on however it is you're going to do the cross product. And you need to be 105% certain that this is your right hand and this is your left hand. Okay? Because I can't do anything except shrug and sort of laugh at you if you come to me and tell me I was doing my left hand. Okay? Make sure you got that right. Be good with the cross product. It will come back to you again in 114. So you're not even going to get rid of it when you're out of this class. It's basically what you have to use to do these three-dimensional things. There's some really cool phenomena in electromagnetism that's really fabulous. If I have a magnetic system, so I have magnetic poles like this, and I take a charge of a beam of positive particles going this way, it doesn't go like this, it goes like that. It's really weird. So you have this thing where if you have a velocity one direction and a magnetic field, the particles will actually move off at right angles. So again, it sort of brings in the cross product and everything you do in electromagnetism. So you sort of can't get rid of it. So get very good at that. And if you're not really comfortable with all these directions and stuff, and the right-hand rule, you may not want to ask a question now, but, you know, grab a friend who knows the stuff, go to office hours, come ask me later, make sure you got it straight. It is really easy once you get it. And I will really ask a lot of questions like this on the exam that are just gimmies. They're meant to be total gimmies, but if you don't understand this, you're going to miss a lot of points. Okay, so now for the fun stuff. We define linear momentum as mass times linear velocity. So we have a thing called angular momentum, which is we define as L, and that's equal to the angular mass, which is moment of inertia, times angular velocity, which is omega. It has a direction, and the angular momentum is in the direction of omega. Okay? It is a vector. So, recall that in the linear world, F equals ma is F is equal to the change of the linear momentum with respect to time, or mdv over dt. Similarly, we can take this equation and sort of look at its linear analog. We can look at the rotational analog. The torque, which is the rotational form of the force, is equal to dl over dt, which is d of this quantity over dt. And if what is rotating has a mass distribution and an amount of mass that's fixed, then you can pull the moment of inertia out, and you get that the torque is equal to I times d omega dt. Just like linear momentum is conserved, in three dimensions. So remember, when you write this down, it's actually three equations, right? X, Y, and Z. Angular momentum is also conserved. And I have the lawyer here. Now I'm just giving you the caveat in an isolated system. Okay? It is conserved independently along each axis where you can consider it isolated. This becomes very relevant in rotation because you have many instances where you have an axis of rotation about something which is really constrained in two dimensions. So if I look at this thing, you can imagine it's friction-free and not constrained around this axis, but it is totally constrained this way or that way. All right. So linear angular momentum is conserved along each orthogonal axis independently. So if you have a wheel or something, you need to consider that as the direction of the axis. If you have a gyroscope, and I was trying to get a good demo in for you, but I have one, but it's in the box, and the box is sealed. There's reasons for that one, but it's sort of pointless for what I wanted to do today. If this were truly free to rotate, and I didn't have to support it, and it's spinning, angular momentum would be conserved along all three axes simultaneously. Okay. So this leads to a whole lot of interesting things. Sit down, I hold it in that orientation. Now I take it and I do this. Okay? When I do this, this still has an angular momentum. It has the same magnitude of angular momentum because it's still spinning at that same speed. If I do this, you know, reasonable fast. I've taken a vector that did this, and it is now like that. Okay? If you forget the transverse dimensions, tell me what's going on along this axis. I have a vector like this. I'm free to rotate. I have a vector like this. The angular momentum is straight up. As I turn it, I am literally taking that vector and reducing the component of it that is along that axis. So, by the act of turning this, I am reducing the contribution of the wheel's angular momentum along that axis. But momentum is conserved. So now I have to spin. so that the whole me gets an angular momentum this way, gets an omega like that, which contributes an angular momentum straight up and keeps the total angular momentum along that axis constant. So it's all angular momentum conservation. So if I had it spinning this way, when I have it spinning this way, I L like that, so that when I change it, I now have to rotate like that. So that's what we just did. Now I'm going to get the same thing, and I'm going to see if I can make it rotate like that. Okay, a different direction. That'll give me an omega down, an L down, and now when I change it, I'm going to have to rotate the other way. Right? When it's spinning this way, and I turn it like that, I was rotating like that. Okay? So let me see. I want it to rotate like that. Things is, as I move this vector like this, there's now a transverse component, so you might ask, why do I not flip over on my hip? And I would if I were in space. But I have the friction of the floor that fights that. So I'm not free to rotate around the transverse axis. Otherwise, it'd be a lot of fun if I were in space. I'd be throwing up by now, probably. But so, okay. So there are lots of strange things that happen with this. So when a quarterback throws a football, what do? They throw the beautiful, perfect spiral. Okay. Now you might think they're throwing that beautiful, perfect spiral because it looks cool. And it does. But one of the other reasons you might think they might throw it in this way is if you have it in the spiral, the football's pointed at both ends. So if you take the pointed end and you were somehow able to keep it so that it was always cutting through the air first, the football is going to sort of go, there'll be less air friction all around, and the air friction that you have will be pushing symmetrically, so that the football isn't going to sort of waft around. Okay? How do you stabilize it? If you take a football and you don't spin it, good luck. You do this, it's like a dead duck. Okay? The whole point in spinning the football is when you let it go, it has an angular momentum. And that angular momentum is conserved, which means the magnitude and direction of that angular momentum will not change unless it is acted on by an external torque, an external force, which basically you don't really have much of with a football. You do have a little bit from the air and stuff, but it's not a lot. So that means it's got a fixed orientation. Can you think of another example sort of like that in life? Do you know what the rifling of a gun is? This is America. If any of you aren't from America, remember we all got guns. Yeah.
1/7 twist.
1/7 twist. Okay. We not only know what the rifling is, we can tell you exactly how it's done. But, okay. So good. What does it do? What the rifling is if you look at it, if you look in a gun barrel, you'll see that it is not smooth like you might naively think it is supposed to be. Okay? In fact, it's got ridges the whole length. And those ridges are in a spiral. Okay? So, naively, that's crazy. This bullet's got to be scraping this stuff all the way out. But what happens is as the bullet's going out, because these rifling grooves go in a spiral, as the bullet goes out, it starts spinning. When you spin the bullet now has a fixed orientation in space. So if the bullet has any elongation, for example, it is now cutting through the air like a football. If you do not rifle that barrel, then the bullet will tumble. And when it tumbles, the air will be hitting it at different angles and push it all directions. So, when some bright person, and I don't actually know, the history's probably known, but when some bright person had this idea of rifling the inside of a barrel of a gun, it was a military revolution. All of a sudden, your shooters were a lot more accurate than the shooters on the other side. So you win. You can shoot them from further away. It's sort of that way in history all the time. You make advances in the technology of bow and arrow, right? It changes how you do things. So that's not the only thing you can do with this. If you have something spinning, momentum is conserved in all three dimensions. Okay? I mean, the angular momentum is. So, what that means is if I have this thing spinning, okay, very fast, if I were able to let it go, its orientation in space would be completely fixed. Okay? So, if you can make a box that surrounds this thing and holds it in such a way that it's free to rotate around all three dimensions, then this thing will just sit there and stay in space, oriented a certain way, regardless of how your box moves. You okay with that? That's something we call a gyroscope. And the reason that's so important is it gives you a fixed frame of reference. Okay? If I have this thing fixed, and I know where it is, I know how it's oriented in space, I can then track. If I put this thing on a boat, I can track the boat's orientation with respect to this fixed direction and how long it goes and how fast I'm going, and I can tell you exactly where I am in three dimensions later on. Because I have this fixed thing that I can refer to, an absolute quantity. And that's a very big deal. In the old days, if you wanted to go to North America from Europe, you sort of got in the boat and you sort of went that way. and you hope that your idea of that way was sort of right. You sort of knew something because the sun would rise on one side and set on the other. And it turns out that you can get sort of one of the orientations on Earth pretty good, but the other one's really hard to track. And the gyroscope gave people a way of doing that. So it allowed navigation to be done seriously better than it was before. And this can affect warfare. It can affect your ability to send things around the Earth, to explore things. I mean, you don't really think about the fact that when you get on an airplane that the dude can actually find your airport. But that's pretty important, actually, that they be able to find the airport, and not only that, know the right one. So that's a big deal. We now have a better way of doing navigation than just the gyroscope. I mean, it was 30 years ago, the gyroscope was what it was. They used gyroscopes. They actually still use gyroscopes on spacecraft and things. So they're very important. We now have the GPS, which you're used to, and that operates in a different way, but it's really important because its accuracy is so good, it's even more important. The GPS system is you have a system of satellites up here, and you take signals from them, and you look at the relative time differences, and from those you can actually determine where you are, depending on the grade of the GPS, to, you know, within feet. And that has opened up a whole new regime of military things, right? You now can equip a missile with one of those and send it through a particular window in a particular building, which opens up geopolitical things at a level that were unimaginable many years ago. If you wanted to get at a bad guy in some city a long time ago, you had to send a big army to take over the city and bomb it to smithereens and hope you got them. Now, in principle, you can do this surgical strike stuff, and you've probably all heard, you know, oh, we should go into Syria because we can do things surgically, right? Or in, earlier it was in the Balkans, okay? And that was one where maybe one argues it was successful. But they, you know, nowadays, because the military strikes in principle can be so accurate, it opens up a whole new regime of things. So this kind of stuff is really important. Okay, too much coffee this morning. Look at this equation, though. What does this tell you? Imagine if I have a wheel that's spinning, I have an axis, and I have a wheel that looks like this. So from your perspective, the front would be on the left. And we're going to give it a sense of rotation like this, all right? Let's suppose I support it here and I support it here. Let's imagine for a moment it is not rotating. It has an angular momentum of zero. I can hold it like that. If I don't support it on one side, it will do what you would expect. It's going to fall. Okay? There's no angular momentum really anywhere. I do get a sliding out because it's rotating for a moment that way. But now let's imagine that it's spinning and I support it on both sides. Okay? I have an angular momentum that's like that. Okay? And now let me put a net torque on this thing. And the way I'm going to put a net torque on it is I'm going to let go on this side. When I let go on the side, I have a center of mass, so gravity is now this way. So gravity gives me a net torque on this object. So I can think the center of gravity is here, so I have mg, like so. I have r, like so. Okay? So what is the direction of the torque on this object? R cross mg is into the board. Okay? Now, does that make sense? If I have a torque that's into the board, and I'm not spinning this thing for the moment, let's say it's not, I have mg here. When I let this go freely, I have a torque that's this way. If I have a torque this way, I get an alpha that's that way, which means I get an omega that's that way, which is why it rotates about this point down like that. Okay? You all right with that? Okay. Now look at this equation. It tells you that the torque tells you the change in omega with respect to time. So it tells me that the omega for the wheel, which I guess I have going this way, okay, which is out that way, changes with respect to time. Vectorially, it has to go that way. So let's see what happens. Explain perception to some of your friends. Remember with the top, you get it spinning up really fast, and I have one, I'm going to bring it. You spin it really fast, it's spinning, and when it's spinning, it will go around a little bit in a circle. It's exactly this phenomenon, that's precession. But what happens when it slows down? Do you remember? It's doing this, and as it slows down, as the spinning slows down, the precession speeds up, so that right before it collapses, the whole thing is sort of doing, it's going around like that fairly fast. Whereas when it's spinning really fast, it barely rotates around. But it rotates around, and you've all seen it 1,000 times, and probably never wondered what the hell it was. Isn't that cool, though? Yeah. So the top is really the same thing. So the top looks... Boy, that's not a good top. Okay. something like this, and you can give it an orientation of spinning, say like that, so that you have L out this way. You also have omega out this way. The torque gives you dL dt, it gives you d omega dt. I'm sorry, it gives you dL dt, which is also the same as I d omega dt. I have mg down this way. Here's R. In this situation, R cross mg gives me a torque into the board. This top spinning with this orientation is going to rotate into the board. One of the reasons I like this particular topic and insist on putting it in this class is that, frankly, you can't really visualize this. I mean, when I show it to you the first time, if you hadn't ever noticed it, it's a little bit of a jaw dropper, because it just, whenever I see it, I'm just like, that really can't work. You know, it's just too weird. This equation vectorially tells you that's exactly what has to happen. But to me, it's one of those places where the human mind is a bit limited, and it's one of the reasons why we have all this complication with torques. I really don't think most people have an intuition that fits this. But the mathematics is very straightforward and tells you exactly what's going to happen. So I think it's pretty interesting from that point of view. So, I'll do an example of it. Let me see. Okay, so I will do mathematical examples of that soon. But let me go ahead and do a few examples involving torque and vectors and stuff. Any questions on some of this weirdness? Yes?
So the torque is going in the same direction, or how is the torque relating exactly to L?
Torque is the change in L with respect to time. Mm-hmm. So vectorially, they have to be in the same direction.
Okay.
And L is I omega, so the angular momentum is always going to be oriented in the same direction as omega. So it's determined by the magnitude and direction of omega.
Thank you.
All right, so let's imagine that we have a thin rod rotating about an axis, which is really around one edge. We'll say it's a thin rod of length L, free to rotate about axis through the end, one end, okay? And we will have a force of 2 newtons here at a distance of 1/2 L, and at a distance L away, I will have a force here of 6 newtons applied at an angle of 30 degrees here. I'll tell you that the mass of the rod is 3 kilograms. The length is 2 meters. Find alpha for the rod at the moment shown. I will give you I of the rod is equal to 1/3 ML squared when you rotate it about one end. And you can ignore all other forces, like gravity. Okay? So the way to do this one, take this thing, copy it, we want to use Newton's rotational law, basically the sum of the torques about the axis of rotation. I mean, it's a one-dimensional rotational problem in the sense that everything is about that one axis. Since it's the axis of rotation, you're not going to have it rotating this way. It's going to have to rotate in this plane, right? One way or the other. So you can say the sum of the torques about that axis is equal to I times alpha. So the total torque is equal to 1/3 ML squared, because this is I, times alpha. And now we have to sum torques.
1/3,
thank you. That's great. When I was in class, it's still to this day, I don't actually listen to what they're saying. I just write it all down. I don't know how many of you are like that. Now I go figure it out later. I was always mystified at people who actually followed and asked questions and caught errors. I was like, really? That's amazing. Okay, so I'm amazed. But thank you for doing it. All right, so now we have to sum the torques. So this one is at right angles to, here's R going from this axis to there for this one. That's at right angles, so it's sort of easy to do. The torque will just be that distance times the force. This one's a little tougher because it's at some angle. So now I have to evaluate the piece of, I have to figure out how to determine what that torque is. And there's sort of two different ways to look at it. I can take R is this guy, and let me call this F2 and this F1. So I'll call this R2 because it's the R that goes from the axis to F2. Then I can take this F2 and I can translate it over to here. And when I do that, I know basically from looking at geometry and parallel axes and everything, if I draw this as the horizontal line, this angle is 30 degrees. Okay? So this total angle here is 120. So you can say that R2 cross F2, which is equal to torque 2, if you want, is going to be equal to the magnitude of R2 times the magnitude of F2 times the sine of 120 degrees. Okay, you can do it that way. Another way to think about it would be to take, here's my R2, here's my F2. This angle is 30 degrees. So I know that this, which I'll call F2 perpendicular, is going to be equal to F2, the magnitude of it, times the cosine of 30. So what I'm doing is I'm saying I want to project out that piece of this vector looking at it over here so that I'm only projecting out the piece that's perpendicular to this R. And in this case, when I do that, I get F2 times the cosine of 30 by the geometry here. And you might say, but wait a minute, I thought it was supposed to be sine. All right, look, the cosine of 30 degrees is going to be the same as the sine of 120. But to me, this is actually easier to visualize. Okay? Once I know this perpendicular thing, then I can take this distance and multiply it by that magnitude, and I'm good for the torque. So you have to be really careful here. You sort of have to live one way or the other way for everything, every torque that you're evaluating. There are some problems, the way that they're written, it is going to be more natural for you to do it one way or the other way. But you can't sort of mix it up within the same force. You have to sort of keep in mind what you're doing. But once you've got that, then the torque sum is really not so bad. So the sum of the torques is going to be equal to, again, you have to sort of define something in terms of orientation. One of these torques, let's say this, the thing that's caused by this force, is going to cause this thing to rotate like that. The other one is going to cause it to rotate that way. Which one do I call positive? You might have a book that tries to give you a convention. I don't even know what the convention is, because I never use it, but there is one. Think of it as a one-dimensional problem. At this point, you just have to define what you mean by a positive torque and a negative torque. And if you want, we'll just define that to be positive in this problem. Once you've defined it, everything else is defined accordingly. So when we did Newton's law problems, there was usually a natural direction. So if I had two masses, and this one was sort of obviously going to be going down the inclined plane, and there was a pulley here, I would sort of define that as the positive direction, which would rotate this thing this way. And if it were going to go like that, I'd call it negative. So it's sort of the same thing here. But when you get into this vector world, I mean, I don't even know. I didn't look at Giancoli, see if he does it. But if they do define a convention, you know, what it really is doing is just giving you a hand in this that you have to adhere to. So in this case, I am going to define this as what I will call the positive direction, meaning a torque that gives me an omega, or gives me an alpha that would... A torque that gives me an alpha that would give me an omega that would give this sense of rotation is what I would call positive. Okay? So in this case, the sum of the torques will be a positive R1 magnitude times F1 magnitude. There's no component necessary. Minus, because the other force is going to make it rotate the other way, R2 in magnitude times F2 in magnitude times the cosine of 30. Because this F2 cosine 30 is really the projection of the perpendicular piece of this force, which is that piece which is relevant for rotation. The piece, the component of this vector that's going from here to there. Right, so... this component will cause no rotation. It just tries to compress the stick. Okay? So that's not relevant. I'm only worrying about the one that's at right angles to that. And that component is going to be F2 times the cosine of 30. So that's what I have here. The sign is that this force causes me to rotate the direction that is opposite what I've defined as positive. So I call it a negative torque. Okay? And in this particular problem, I now have all the pieces I need. I have that 1/3 ML squared alpha is equal to 1/2 L times 2 newtons minus L times 6 newtons times the cosine of 30. And to really do the problem, I'd have to give you M and L to determine alpha. Any questions? Okay, so I did give you M and L, actually. Sorry. So since I've given you M and L up here as two, the mass is 3 and L is 2 meters. When I calculated it, so you can check yourself, I got that alpha was equal to minus 2.1 radians per second squared. The minus sign here means alpha is oriented in the same direction as a negative torque would be. So alpha is going to act to give you an omega that will cause you to be rotating like that, because that's what will give you the negative sign. Okay? Let's stop there. That's enough for today.